welcome to another edition, the last edition of the new WHFR Journal for 2016. Today is December 30th, 2016, and next year we'll be 1 year older, as they say, all of us, because it'll be 2017. So this show today, I'd like to reflect back on some of the highlights of the last year, but it won't be boring because it won't be the same things we talked about in the show, which is usually the highlights each week. So we'll do an overview, and of course some of these important issues range nationally as well as internationally. And so we hope you stay tuned today. College, if you are listening to the broadcast, the college is doing an upgrade on our instructional technology network, and so we're only broadcasting, but this show I am recording right now and will uplink to the to our server as soon as everything gets back up in place. So if you're listening after December 30th, you won't know the difference. So why did I bring it up? Okay. A story we've had a couple of weeks was in the Metro Times on December 16th. Say yes to Michigan. And you can say yes to Detroit, too, I guess, because although this is one of those dubious honors, Detroit tops the list of 2016's neediest cities. Here's the story. Detroit tops the list of most neediest cities in a new study released by WalletHub, which compares 150 of the most populated U.S. cities while factoring in child poverty, food insecurity, meaning starving to death, I guess, and a number of people starving to death, and uninsured rates. Within the report, Detroit is also top list of highest child poverty rates and highest adult property rates, poverty rates. So both kids and adults are the highest in poverty, highest percent in poverty across all the United States, of 150 of the most populated U.S. cities. Among cities with the highest food insecurities, Detroit ranked only five. Top five for worst food insecurities. Here's a quote from Michelle Miller Adams, professor in the Department of Political Science at Grand Valley State University. She says in the report, in terms of race and ethnicity, poverty rates for African-American and Hispanic individuals far exceed the average for the nation. In terms of household status, those most likely to be poor are households headed by a single female. Needless to say, children born to African-American or Hispanic single mothers are the demographic group most likely to be poor. Miller Adams also points out the fact that minimum wage has failed to rise with inflation, and most of the income gains experienced in the U.S. have gone to the wealthy. While the idea of the American dream lives on, data show that it is a myth. Children in the U.S. are less likely than children in other developed countries to change social classes over their lifetime. This poses a huge challenge for social policy and explains a great deal of the public distrust of political institutions. Our society has failed in one of its most fundamental promises, that people can expect to live better lives than their parents did. That's an extended quote from Michelle Miller Adams, professor in the Department of Political Science at Grand Valley State University, right here in Michigan, who did the study interpreted the study by WalletHub. So 60% of being the neediest city in the whole United States of the top 150, 60% of that rating comes from economic well-being, which means not very well off economically, and 40% are various health and safety factors. I did look up the complete report. By the way, did I mention? My name is Jay Koronek, station advisor at WHFR.FM. Station making waves, happy to be with you here today. Yes, we're live from our studios on the Henry Ford College campus. I also want to thank, right at the outset, too, probably thank them at the end, all of our volunteer staff members that have kept WHFR on the air for the whole holiday period, even though the college has been closed since 22nd of December. It will reopen for business, Monday the 2nd, but maybe the 3rd. We don't have the internet up right now here because of that IT upgrade, as I said. So I have to double check on that. But classes start here. The winter semester classes start on January the 9th, Monday, January the 9th. So as soon as you can get online, not today, because all the servers are down as well as our internet connection. You can't look at the server or register today because, as I said, all the circuits are down. You can't connect. But I'm happy to be here with you. So, unfortunately, Detroit is top on the list of the neediest cities in 2016. Also, somewhat negative, Metro Times just yesterday put a little list together of their top 10 stories, but of course, the top story to a muckraking, no-holds-barred weekly journal that only takes ads, but it has amazingly good investigative journalists and amazingly strong opinions that are well-researched. And I highly recommend you try to pick up Metro Times. And if you can't, MetroTimes.com is their website. So here's their top 10 stories that are some of the craziest, most upsetting, most outlandish about Michigan in this era, Michigan. Number one, Detroit teachers are using Twitter to document poor school conditions. DPS teachers started using the Twitter handle @TeachDetroit to show photos of the awful conditions of the schools. The photos showed crumbling walls, mold, leaky ceilings, and other horrors. That was a good idea. It did get some attention. And that was before the legislature did vote a support package, sort of a bailout. Not a very complete bailout, but hundreds of millions of dollars because of the disaster of the last emergency managers for, not Detroit in this case, but the Detroit Public Schools. Are they on their fifth emergency manager, the Detroit Public Schools? And they're still not being able to do the job that they should for the students of Detroit. But I think that was a great move by Detroit teachers to use Twitter and get those pictures of those crumbling walls, mold, leaky ceilings, and rats. I think they got a few rats in there. Story number two from the Metro Times from 2016, top stories. This DPS student's open letter puts the sickouts into perspective. Renaissance High School student Imani Harris wrote an open letter in wake of the sickouts that were happening in DPS. Imani's letter struck a chord with a lot of people and showed that students are just as fed up with the district as parents and the teachers. Top story number three, Governor Snyder's Flint aid bill signing was a PR disaster. And they don't go on to describe it, but understand this is after the whole poison water fiasco of Flint. And then he has to have a big PR, woo, whoop-de-doo, I'm signing an aid bill. When it was his administration, his appointed emergency managers, the incompetence that went, well, all the way now, apparently, according to the latest charges that were brought against even an assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. No, Bill Schuette wouldn't charge himself. Of course not. And nor has the governor been charged with any wrongdoings here. But what did they know and when did they know it? I think Jack Lessenbury brought that up last week. So that was an ironic, hilarious, and just stupid moment to try to make a positive PR spin out of the Flint aid disaster by the people that basically caused it. Michigan, story number four, Michigan to welcome first full-scale Chick-fil-A's next month in January. The once homophobic fast food chain restaurant, actually they might still be homophobic, we're not sure, says the Metro Times, announced that they were opening multiple restaurants in Michigan and people lost their minds. Not because they wanted the food, okay, but because of the racism inherent in some statements made by the heads of the Chick-fil-A's organization. Top story number five, new emails reveal the switch to the Flint River water, was not about saving money. Motor City Muckraker, which is one of their own people, I guess, in a disguised name, obtained emails that basically laid out that the switch to the vile Flint River water had nothing to do with saving money at all. And they still wonder here, Metro Times very opinionated, why Rick Snyder isn't in jail yet. They have strong opinions. By the way, all opinions on this show, whether I'm reading them or speaking them myself, are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford College, faculty, staff, students, or administrators. But we appreciate the fact that they allow us to say these things, and we try to be fair and balanced as much as possible. And we let you know who you're listening to. Metro Times here. Story number 6, Royal Oak school kids chant, "Build a wall," while Latino classmates cry. Just days after the election, that is the November 4th presidential election, a video surfaced of Royal Oak middle schoolers, that's junior high schoolers, chanting, "Build a wall," in the cafeteria. Come on, Royal Oak parents, says the Metro Times, don't you teach your kids to be better than that? 7, Dearborn Police Department is the first in the country to have a uniformed officer who also wears a hijab. Amal Shamut became the first officer in the country to don a white a hijab while on duty, and all we have to say is, you go, girl. That's the Metro Times. Story number 8, public vows to boycott Bookies Bar and Grill following inflammatory Facebook rant. Seems that it's not just Chick-fil-A's, but also Bookies Bar and Grill got into trouble in this. Good to social media for things like that that draw attention to people that are limited in their, is my term here, somewhat limited in their perspectives on the world and life in general and people. Number 9, top stories from Metro Times, Trump's titties flub, and I missed this one originally, now a Detroit ghetto house anthem. Trump made a stop in Detroit and may or may not have said titties instead of the word city. A local DJ took the sound bit and transformed it into a ghetto house banger called Massive Titties in Detroit. And the rest is history, says the Metro Times. Have to look that one up, I guess. Massive Titties in Detroit. Can I say that word on the radio? Maybe Donald Trump said the word. I don't know. 10, new anti-Trump billboard appears over I-94 in Arabic. And the sign simply said, Donald Trump, he can't read this, but he is afraid of it. And that was very special. That was a great idea and well carried out. I'm not sure how many misinterpreted it and thought it was a Muslim takeover of a Dearborn or somewhere else, which is not going to happen. I mean, we're working it out here, folks. We're together here in Dearborn, as far as I know. All of us. I'm not Muslim, but that doesn't mean anything, okay? I'm a person, and so here we are. Yep. I have good news for you. The Kitty Love is in the house. Yes, she is. Our Highway 61 Blues DJ has just entered the gateway to WHFR, and she'll be on at 2 o'clock today with the best in the blues from 2 to 4. Back to the, that was the top stories, okay, according to the Metro Times. And again, some are on the staff side, okay, let's say it that way. Here's some positive things, but this is from a progressive, a great writer, John Nichols, who is very intelligent and never writes in less than 5 or 10,000 words. But I love words. I love to read them. I love to think about things. I try to share some of those thoughts with you in this very short 1 hour each Friday. He looks back at 2016 and from a progressive political analysis, he says it's been an awful year. But there are some good points. Most valuable political campaign, Bernie Sanders, who, of course, won Michigan in the Democratic primary. That didn't work out, but it was an amazing campaign because of what he was saying and how he was different from Hillary Clinton and the connection with the majority of Americans, I think. Most valuable struggle to John Nichols in 2016 was to stand with Standing Rock. Let me explain this. By the time most Americans had heard about the Dakota Access Pipeline Project, it was close to completion. That's because the major media didn't think it was worth anything. But the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota kept raising objections to the project's plans to tunnel under the Missouri River, which would threaten not just sacred lands of theirs, but access to safe drinking water for the Sioux and for millions of people living downriver. Did you get that, folks? Millions of people living downriver. Tribes from across the country and indigenous peoples from around the world recognized the importance of the struggle to prevent completion of the oil pipeline as planned. They were joined by Bill McKibben. He's a major spokesperson, or maybe the founder, of 350.org. That's 350.org, one of those websites to write down and maybe check out, folks, in the new year. And besides Bill McKibben, other climate change activists were part of this movement in person, standing up to the fossil fuel industry. Amy Goodman, I'm adding here, with her photographer, went there to cover the story and promptly got arrested. She was just too famous a person not to get arrested. You know, who cares about all those Native Americans, those Indians that were there, right? They're living on reservations. They're, you know, practically imprisoned. They have no money, no power, no influence. We don't care about them. But we're going to arrest Amy Goodman when she shows up to simply report the story. Now, luckily, after she was charged and had to go back, she was in jail. She was charged with, I don't know, violent disruption. Yeah, violent with a camera. And the unfortunate thing is the charges were dropped for her, but her camera person is still being charged and will come up for trial in 2017. That doesn't make any sense to me. Okay. It doesn't at all. Luckily, as that worked out, the intersectional movement delayed the project, and in early December, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers refused to issue the permits needed to complete it. So the feds will now consider alternative routes, quote unquote. Despite this major victory, the struggle is far from over, as Energy Transfer Partners, that's the pipeline's developer, has powerful allies in Congress and the incoming administration. Republicans, if you're not too smart about that, who they are. Yet as Naomi Klein, and again, a great writer, Naomi Klein, K-L-E-I-N, she's several books, fantastic analysis of current events, state of the nation. Well, she's from Canada, so it's the state of several of our nations. She says that the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline has shown, quote, people everywhere that organizing and resistance are not futile. Okay, just a couple other highlights from John Nichols of good points for the progressives in this country. Most valuable mayor in the United States of America, Dr. Karen Weaver, he points out, a Clint psychologist who defeated the incumbent mayor of Flint, Michigan in November 2015 after a campaign in which she vowed to address that city's water crisis. Weaver declared a state of emergency upon taking office and began demanding accountability and aid, complaining that, quote, the people weren't put first, the health of the people was not put before profit and money. She urged visiting politicians from President Obama to Hillary Clinton to Michigan Governor Rick Snyder and Donald Trump to recognize the damage done to urban centers by corporations and government agencies that have neglected basic duties owed to humanity. Seeking access to clean water and infrastructure investments to replace the corroded pipes that leached lead in the city's tap water, this activist mayor declared, we've got to get this fixed. And the current state, according to, I did check out michiganradio.org on the web before I came in today, and there, the state of Michigan, that's right, our Attorney General Bill Schuette on orders from Rick Snyder. How soon I forget his last name. Why do I want to do that? Who, by the way, is not signing any of these lame duck session bills. No, he decided to take a trip to Europe. Oh, it's politically motivated, yes. No, or he's just running out of time for the Christmas holidays. But he left all those bills, and there was a whole bunch of them, on his desk. And so it's up to Lieutenant Governor Kerry. It's not Jim Kerry. No, that's the actor, the comedian. No, but whatever his name is. Kerry, who's a nice guy. I mean, I met him once. I thought he was a nice guy. I don't know. But he's been signing bills right and left from the lame duck session, and we'll report more about those next week. Pretty much we gave an indication of what could be signed last week, and Lieutenant Governor Kerry has been signing most of them. But isn't it interesting that Snyder doesn't need to sign any of them, whether they're good or bad? He can be out of town. He's got, a month's winter vacation to take, after all, with his family, because he did such a great job this year. He needs to celebrate. Or, my suggestion, he'd rather be out of town for a while. Yeah. Not think about what's happening in Michigan. Because you remember his other trip to Europe? That was just 5 days after he went to Flint and drank a glass of filtered water and took a pledge to the people of Flint that for the next 30 days, he would only drink filtered Flint water. 5 days later, he's on his way to Europe. And they just couldn't take the Flint water with them. It's just logistics. Hey, the plane wouldn't allow, 100 gallons of Flint water. Besides, what if it would start leaking on the plane and contaminating and rusting the structure of the plane? I don't know. So I wish him very happy Christmas and happy New Year to our governor. I thought he might change. A lot of us thought he would be doing a better job when he was first voted on, and I think he's proven he can't. And, of course, he is term limited. Thank goodness for small favors, which is a law that I'm against, and I don't think it should be there. But the voters of Michigan spoke, and they reelected him several years ago, and so we got a chance to do more. Or what he did in the first 4 years, which did not impress me anyway. Let's see here. Most valuable activist is Lori Wallach, who you might not have heard her name before, but she campaigned against the Trans-Pacific Partnership issue, TPP. That's an agreement among countries around the Pacific Rim, not China, but everybody but China. And she's director of the nonprofit organization Public. Well, they're nonprofit, but you can't donate to them because they're a lobbyist group, too. They try to affect public policy, so you don't get tax deduction for that. But the group is Public Citizen, which was originally founded by Ralph Nader, who hasn't been part of that group. But the group goes on doing, I think, good things. Definitely consideration at the end of the year for a donation if you want to donate to an organization. Yes, they do have a nonprofit, I think, educational fund that you can donate to. But basically, they're doing a heck of a job. John Nichols thinks that Lori Wallach did a fantastic job of covering the whole TPP story. Most valuable commentator, he actually says it's Van Jones on CNN. He says, unlike the pundits who responded to every unsettling development by resorting to shallow talking points, Jones was informed and insightful in his approach. By the way, Van Jones once served as President Obama's Green Jobs Advisor, argued that, quote, a bipartisan political consensus, unquote, forged by elites in both parties had sold out working Americans. Yet Jones was never willing to settle for simplistic explanations regarding the response to that sellout. Jones recognized the, quote, rebellion against the elites, unquote, that defined much of the 2016 campaign, but he demanded that others recognize the racial component in what he described as the white lash against a changing country. With equal measures of intellect and humanity, Jones wrestled ably and honestly what he referred to as the messy truth of American politics in the 2016 election. Most valuable free press campaigner, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, featured only on Fridays, but on Fridays here at WHFR.FM. Okay, most valuable state electoral reform, ranked choice voting. We talked about it before. And it is a great thing. We'll see how that works out for Maine. It's also called instant runoff system. Under the new plan, voters will, if you don't remember my explanation, still not clear what it is. Under the new plan, voters will rank candidates in order of preference, with the votes of losing candidates being reassigned to more viable preferences until a clear winner emerges. That is a total majority. No spoilers, no wasted votes. State Representative Diane Russell says the system, quote, allows Mainers, they call themselves Mainers, to vote their hopes, quote unquote. That freedom and flexibility, says John Nichols, will advance the promise of democracy, and the group Fair Vote is working to get other states to embrace that promise. Most valuable movie, he thinks, is Oliver Stone's Snowden. He recommends that you find out more about, of course, Edward Snowden. And that's one way to do it. He recommends, actually, the documentary that won an Oscar called Citizen Four, directed by Laura Poitras, P-O-I-T-R-A-S. Already won an Oscar, okay, probably last year, last January, Citizen Four. And either one, it's something you should watch and learn about. What did Edward Snow do? And why did he do it? But Oliver Stone's political films are always very entertaining, a little bit over the top sometimes, but very persuasive. And in this case, I think they need to be. Anyway, okay, that's that story. It's a time for New Year's resolutions. But we're going to take a musical break here on WHFR.FM and our new WHFR journal to listen to a song by Roy Milton's Solid Serenaders entitled New Year's Resolution Blues.
What's the matter with you, man? Hey, it is New Year and you're sitting over there like you salted the world.
Yes, I'm salty. I've been misled, I've been mistreated, and I've been misused.
Boy, she really made a chunk out of you.
Yeah, but I made a New Year's resolution, and I'm really going to get her told.
What you going to tell her?
I tell you what I'm going to tell her. Get a load of this. I made my New Year's resolution. Tell you what I'm going to do. Just forget about the old year and the things we used to do. Going to take instead of giving, cause my lesson I've learned. Going to get the things I wanted and give nothing in return. Cause I've changed my ways, and I don't care what you do. I've made my New Year's resolution, and baby, this time we're through. I'm gonna deal 'em from the bottom, ain't gonna play it fair at all. Please believe me, pretty baby, I'm gonna have myself a ball. Gonna give up my apartment, and you know they're hard to find. I don't want no last year's memories running through my weary mind. Cause I've changed my way, and I don't care what you do. Yes, I've made my New Year's resolution, and baby, this time we're through. My way of living, you don't fit in my new plan, so you might as well forget it and go find another man. Cause I've changed my way. Yes, I've changed my way. I've made my New Year's resolution, and baby, this time we're through.
Perhaps you feel that way about a lot of things. And from 2016, certainly we're constantly reminded at the end of the year about the great music artists who have passed this year. And, of course, in the last couple of days, both Debbie Reynolds and her daughter Carrie Fisher died within a day of each other. That just is at the top of our minds, of course. But every person's death diminishes us. Every person's life should in some way enhance us if we can understand who each of us are accurately. Love and compassion, very important things this time of year. Jay Koronick with you here in the new WHFR Journal, December 30th, 2016. Let's jump into some opinions here. Our two big local editorial commentators. Let's see. Let's do Craig Foran first. And you might say, and everybody from the News Herald knows that he has a bunch of people that don't like him downriver. And he is carefully identified as a liberal. But here's an article from him written just 2 days ago, and it's on the News Herald website. He starts with, as he usually does, quote from, in this case, George Bernard Shaw, a playwright and critic. Democracy substitutes election by the incompetent, many, for appointment by the corrupt, few. George Bernard Shaw, playwright, essayist, too, at the end of the 19th century, didn't like the masses too much. So how does that relate to us? Well, let's get into Craig Foran's editorial. From the moment the election was over, I had people write and tell me to give Donald Trump a chance. I had some especially criticize me when I went from a conciliatory tone immediately after the election to one more critical the following week. But I keep coming back to one question. How did so many people think Donald Trump could solve their problems? Would even care about their problems? What does a rich guy from New York City have in common with any blue-collar worker in Michigan, and especially downriver? Yet, people wanted me to give him a chance. Well, before I could even try, any thought of me giving him a chance was dashed by the Donald himself. For it didn't take long for the Donald to add to the muck of Washington, that's Washington, D.C., instead of, quote, draining the swamp, unquote. Which just reinforces my point that the carnival barker has little interest in the concerns of most of us. Consider, if you will, his league of extraordinarily unqualified gentlemen, and a couple of women, he's appointing to his cabinet and administration. Secretary of State Tex Tillerson, as CEO of ExxonMobil Corporation, would be the first Secretary of State, going back to Thomas Jefferson, without government or military experience. This is the guy whose sole purpose in life has been to maximize profits for an oil company, and to that end he has had a long and valuable business relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. How can he possibly be a fair broker in world affairs? What happens when American interests fall counter to the interest of ExxonMobil and other big businesses? Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has worked at Goldman Sachs for 17 years and founded the entertainment financing company Rat Pack Dune Entertainment, among other things. Look for it on movie screens. Keep in mind, according to a scathing report in Forbes magazine, Goldman Sachs, quote, worked with hedge funds to be against the toxic mortgages after the crash of 2008 had started. They made money by selling short on the financial catastrophe they had created. Goldman Sachs was fined $550 million for its actions, unquote. That's from Forbes magazine. It was not exactly a left-wing progressive journal. Craig Foran continues, yeah, I want this guy in charge of our financial system. Secretary of Defense nominee Senator James Mattis retired from the Marine Corps in 2013 after 41 years of service. Problem is that federal law prohibits Mattis from being appointed until he's been retired for 7 years, not four. Yes, Congress can pass a waiver, but not even Mattis reaches levels of a General George C. Marshall, who was the only person to ever have been granted such a waiver. Mattis may be good, but he's no marshal, and he may be too military for a job that requires no demands, civilian authority. Attorney General appointee U.S. Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican Alabama, is the guy who tried to block the auto bailout in 2008. If you're an auto worker or any kind of blue-collar worker, you have to wonder what he had in mind for us. If the bailout had been blocked, Michigan would have lost between 1 and 3 million jobs, between 1 million and 3 million jobs, according to a study by the Center for Automotive Research. Interior Secretary U.S. Representative Ryan Zinke, Republican from Montana, is a retired Navy SEAL who can't seem to keep a position on climate change. In 2010, he co-signed a letter to President Obama that called for, quote, comprehensive clean energy jobs and climate change legislation, unquote. By 2014, looking at moving up in politics, he changed his views, saying climate change is, quote, not a hoax, but it's not proven science either. And we have to say on the show, because I think it's the responsibility of every intelligent, well-researched journalist to say when a fact is not a fact. Okay? He's wrong. Climate change is happening, and yes, it's serious, and yes, we're doing it to ourselves. Okay? It's mostly caused by human activity and pollution, so on. Secretary of Commerce. Wilbur Ross is a billionaire investor who, according to a report by Derek Kravitz of ProPublica, quote, has made a fortune in the steel industry, an industry of which the Commerce Department has significant oversight. And continuing with that report from ProPublica, Craig Ferran states, indeed, government transition documents show that the Commerce Department is slated to make no fewer than five decisions about steel trade soon after the inauguration, which will directly affect businesses that Ross has a stake in, unquote. Ferran continues, and with steel still being a major industry in our backyard, you have to be concerned about which side Ross's decisions would fall. Labor Secretary nominee Andy Puzder is CEO of the fast food chain that owns Carl's Jr.'s and Hardee's and is on the record as opposing raising the minimum wage. Or as the LA Times put it, quote, he is one of the nation's most effective spokespersons for the rights and privileges of fast food franchisers. But as a spokesman for the rights of workers, especially the low-wage workers employed in his chains, he doesn't rank, unquote. Ferrand, so his view of labor is purely from employer's point of view. Health and Human Services. U.S. Representative Tom Price, Republican from Georgia, is a longtime opponent of Obamacare, but like his fellow Republicans, doesn't have a plan for replacing it. Oh, and he wants to change Medicare and Medicaid, so don't get sick on his watch. Housing and Urban Development Secretary nominee Dr. Ben Carson is a retired neurosurgeon who has no qualifications whatsoever to serve in government, just like I have no business doing brain surgery. Energy Secretary nominee Rick Perry will end up leading one of the federal agencies he famously said he wanted to eliminate, but couldn't remember its name. Oops, he said, which is what I say about his appointment. Education Secretary nominee Betty DeVos of Amway fame, say yes to Michigan, is famous or infamous for her disdain for public education and support for charter schools, among other things. Yes, she's going to bat for education? Clearly not for all education, says Craig Ferran. Homeland Security nominee General John Kelly retired as a former commander of U.S. Southern Command. He could be one of the few thinking people in the Trump administration since, according to reports, quote, he's known for his strong knowledge of border issues and the drug trade in South America and Central America, unquote. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, that's C-H-A-O, previously served as Labor Secretary for President George W. Bush. Oh, and she's married to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, but don't hold that against her. She's good. The other two cabinet positions, Veterans Affairs and Agriculture, had yet to be announced as of last Friday, okay, when he wrote this, even though it was published this Wednesday. But I'm leaning toward either administration or Admiral Michelle Howard or General Ann Dunwoody for VA and Republican Idaho Governor Butch Otter for Agriculture. He goes on to conclude, as for other administration jobs, are equally questionable. U.S. Ambassador, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has no experience on the international stage. SBA, Small Business Administration. Linda McMahon's claim to fame is being co-founder of a fake wrestling company. How that qualifies to run the Small Business Administration is beyond the comprehension of everyone. Oh, wait, she was a top donor to Trump's campaign, but if he needed to thank her, he could have put her in charge of White House Entertainment. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is Oklahoma's Attorney General and a longtime critic of an environmental protection agency that, in this case, he would run. He denies climate change, considers most science dubious, quote-unquote, and is opposed to environmental protection in general. Michigan, our region, is filled with outdoorsmen and women who love the environment. We're home to the largest wildlife refuge in the nation, threatened by pollution from all directions. And this is a guy who'll be in charge of protecting the water, land, and air around us? He goes on to say, there are others being appointed. Craig Ferran, again, NewsHerald.com. Others being appointed equally important jobs, chief of staff, national security advisor, CIA director, but you get the idea. The Donald is promoting people who, for the most part, are wholly unqualified for the positions, at odds with the purpose of the position, or who couldn't care less about what's important to you. Yet many of you voted for the man and are hoping for the best. But I'm not seeing it. The Donald's cabinet will be filled with people of privilege, mostly white males, with very little in common with us, our needs, our hopes, and our dreams. They hardly reflect our values, let alone our demographics. Yet people have told me to give the Donald a chance. Sorry, but I think the onus is on him. And so far, all the Donald has given us is a deck of cards filled with jokers. Happy New Year, he concludes. That's Craig Ferrand. We don't normally feature all of his opinions because He has a lot of them, but he goes on at length. And I think this was a great summary. Okay, a little abbreviated in terms of descriptions of each candidate, but he's stating facts about the qualifications of these people that Donald Trump has said are going to be his appointees. Now, they have to be still, I think, approved, but then Congress is vast majority Republicans, so it shouldn't have too big a problem unless there's some major protest and demonstrations and letter writing and emailing and Twittering and so on, and we'll see how that goes. Obviously, some of these people, almost by any criteria, are not qualified for the office that they're appointed to. Of course, that's my opinion. Welcoming to the studio our WHFR News and Sports Director, John Conroy. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Jay. It's good to be here. How are you?
Okay. Is it cold out there? Give me the weather report. I've been here for 2 hours.
It's a little bit chilly and a little windy out there. Yes, it is. And yeah. A little snow flurry at times as well.
That's what they produce. I think tomorrow's going to be a little bit warmer. Might go up to 40 if that's any good news for you. You planning for a big New Year's Eve?
Very low-key I'm going to shoot for. A lot of good football games and basketball games and that type of thing.
Apparently at midnight tomorrow night, it's been just a couple of years now, or maybe this is only the second year, but they're going to drop a big D, that is the letter D for Detroit, somewhere in Detroit, downtown. They're going to lower the D to the ground at midnight, sort of like the ball with many lights on it comes down in Times Square in New York City, and we've got a D.
That'll be around the Campus Martius area.
Probably.
And we'll also do that in Wyandotte this year.
You have a D too?
Not a D, but a W.
Oh, I see. Everybody's got their own letter. Maybe I should lower a K on my yard. Everybody lowering some lighted representation of themselves. Okay. Well, however you'd like to celebrate that. I already played a New Year's Resolution Blues, which was kind of a sad song. By the way, we're supposed to back announce here on WHFR, but get out of habit since this is not a music show. It was Roy Milton's Solid Serenaders from a great classic anthology called Blues, Blues Christmas, which also includes some New Year's songs like that one. And it's not what you expect, but these are recordings made over that 30-year period. And they're very different. Let me just put it that way. It's some classic blues performances, and we don't have time for all that. But downriver, any downriver news, John?
Well,
all the bridges still working to Gros Isle?
Bridges are still working.
Okay, that's good.
The man that went over the sidewalk, I should say, is fine. They went. A gentleman drove his car right from his driveway and went over the embankment and into the river. And
goodness.
Thankfully, the river's edge was frozen enough so that the car didn't sink. It flipped over.
I see.
And there was people going by who saw the gentleman. And
Was he trying to end something?
No, he was just, okay. just was out of sorts of some sort. And
couldn't tell the difference between the road and the river.
Instead of making that turn when he hit the West River Road, he kept right on going. You know.
Yeah, that's the thing about an island is you have to keep turning.
Yes.
Or you're going to be in the water. Yeah. Okay.
You got to watch out for that stone wall that's in the way there too. So.
Yeah. Don't start the party early, folks, and before you're done driving, because that could be a problem.
There's a nice show happening featuring Alexander Zonchik, and he is going to be he's starting his own radio program. I shouldn't promote it too much, but it's airing. It's starting Saturday, 7:30 p.m. on WADL TV 38.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it's going to be Alexander Zonchik from A to Z, drawing on his friendships with well-known musicians. He's created a hybrid TV show
Okay.
that's part concert and part interview.
We need some options on what to watch. I think that's good.
Yeah.
One story we missed this year, and I carried it with me from last April, but it's still true about 2016. It was not a good year since you brought up the man driving badly, but could have been a suicide attempt. Who knows? Certainly drinking heavily and driving is like a suicide omission. Story from the New York Times, Friday, April 22nd. Suicide surges to its highest rate in 30 years. Suicide in the United States has surged to the highest levels in nearly 30 years, a federal data analysis has found, with increases in every age group except older adults. The rise was particularly steep for women. By the way, older adults are the ones that typically commit suicide the most. So when I say, not older adults, again, it's just increases. The increases are up in every age group. The rise was particularly steep for women. It was also substantial among middle-aged Americans, sending a signal of deep anguish from a group whose suicide rates have been stable or falling since the 1950s. The increases were so widespread that they lifted the nation's suicide rate to 13 people per 100,000, the highest rate since 1986. The rate rose by 2% a year starting in 2000, double the annual rise in the earlier period of the study. In all, 42,773 people died from suicide in 2014, compared with 29,119 in 1999. Okay, so think about that numbers. We had almost 43,000 people die from suicide in 2014, the last year they have data for in this study. Okay. And that's more people than died in all the car accidents, which are about the same number, though, each year. And homicides in the U.S., I just saw that number last year, 13,000 homicides, people killing other people with one kind of device or the other. I guess you could strangle, too, but without needing a tool. You need your hands for that. But that was only 13,000. And how many of those were terrorist deaths called by so-called terrorists. It was only something like last year, something about 13 or 14. Just to keep it in perspective, okay? It's very, very low numbers, even though we're always saying, terrorism is everywhere, and we're being killed and raped and looted, and those numbers are not factored in at all. But I thought you should know and think about, what are we going to do about the people in our own country and around the world who are killing themselves? Yes, a few of them may have it very bad in terms of their health. We should have programs for euthanasia. Jack Kevorkian wasn't able to bring that about here in Michigan, but seemed like an idea. Nonetheless, we don't know a breakdown about people who were, terminally ill, being part of the 43,000. I don't think there's many in that group that way. So American Indians, by the way, that is Native Americans, had the sharpest rise of all racial and ethnic groups, with rates rising by 89% for women and 38% for men. White middle-aged women had an increase of 80%. On top of the Arab American rates, too. The rate declined for just one racial group, black men, and declined for only one other age group, men and women over 75. The data provided fresh evidence of suffering among white Americans. Recent research has highlighted the plight of less educated whites, showing surges in deaths from drug overdoses, suicides, liver disease, and alcohol poisoning, particularly among those with a high school education or less. A quote from Robert D. Putnam, professor of public policy at Harvard University. He says, quote, "This is part of the larger emerging pattern of evidence of the links between poverty, hopelessness, and health." I wanted to toss in there that veterans, U.S. military veterans, are committing suicide at an average of 22 per day, almost 700 a year. Figured into those numbers, I assume, but that's very, very sad. But I think there's reason for that. You can probably figure out some of the reasons for that. But that's something to consider and work on, to try to eliminate the poverty, the inequality both economic and social, in 2017 and beyond. We all have to work to do better because there's not much hope for a lot of people in this country. In fact, the surveys show for this year that we have more of a class struggle in this country than in England or anywhere else around the world. So the hope for your children to do better or to move up in status in any category is less than it's ever been, and it's less than most every other so-called civilized Western country right now. And that's not what we want to have here in America. So we're going to need some significant changes, and I haven't heard them from our president-elect yet. You want to say anything, John?
I will say again what I've said, I like to say every week, and that is I'm wearing red today, and that is my acronym.
So am I, by the way. Well, very good. Sort of reddish-purple, but
reddish
still.
Reddish-purple, that's fine.
Close enough.
But that is, again, related to my R.E.D., remember, everyone deployed.
And I say that if we didn't have many wars and violence caused that way, obviously we wouldn't have the problems with our veterans, whether it's the problems of needing health care and rehabilitation when they return, or, and if it's not physical, it might be mental problems, such as might cause you to be so depressed to lead to suicide. It's, you know, we have to find the cause of war and violence. And I'm going to shift to, okay, something else that I brought in. January 1st is a World Day of Peace. That was started by the United Nations. And actually, no, I think I'm wrong about that. The World Day of Peace, maybe it was certified by them. Anyway, that was 1967, January 1st. And so it's usually the Pope of the Catholic Church, in this case Pope Francis, they have an address. They have a statement about peace. And on this 50th year, you might say, well, after 50 years, we haven't quite got there. Well, in all the civilization of human beings, whether you think it's 20,000 years or more, we haven't made too much progress here. There's always been wars, and it's not something that we need to consider living with anymore. No more war is just a simple statement. War does not gain advantages in the long run for any of us. That's my opinion. I've told you I had strong opinions, and by golly, the last show of this year might be my last show ever. Who knows?
did we already give the disclaimer?
Yes, we already gave the disclaimer, yes. So Pope Francis said, everyone can be an artisan of peace. Being peace creates peace. We can all cultivate peace by looking within and committing to a spirituality of active nonviolence. Now, he believes that no religion is terrorist, and he points out that the word Islam means peace. Sort of like Catholics greeting one another during a service on Sundays, peace be with you.
Peace be with you.
Mm-hmm. And that, as somebody once said, Christianity is a great idea if anybody would ever try it. If you ever look at the basics of love, compassion, and peace. Pope Francis points out in his more extensive comment that I can't read, is that nonviolence is more powerful than violence. He says, direct quote from Pope Francis, from his statement for January 1st, 2017, nonviolence is sometimes taken to mean surrender, lack of involvement and passivity, but this is not the case. When Mother Teresa received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979, she clearly stated her own message of active nonviolence. We and our family don't need bombs and guns to destroy and to bring peace, just to get together, love one another. So there you are. Just chokes me up there.
Chokes
me up. Yep. And of course, Mother Teresa finally was proclaimed a saint by Pope Francis last September. Okay. Oh my goodness, I'm looking over here and Kitty Love is doing a best of the blues from her show for 2016, and she has probably 20 or 30 different CDs, all with notes on them about best tracks.
And 2 hours.
And she's only got 2 hours. So we better go out on time today. She's going to be very mad if she doesn't get all of these included. Yeah, well, we'll see. Okay.
We'll see.
Finally, I need to end with a book recommendation. Ah. Okay, I could make. I think I've made many along the way, and I also have a poem to read. So I don't know if we're going to get in here, John. I know you have some final thoughts. Probably I'll try to give you a moment for those. Okay.
Thank you, Jay.
Okay, the book that I discovered a few weeks ago, and it's not very positive week. It was written not very positive book, but it's something to think about. It's entitled "Our Final Invention." Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. Sorry. Yeah. The author is James Barrett, Barrett, and it was written in 2013. And you might say, well, it's out of date then. What does he know? But in fact, he looks at it this way. I'm just going to summarize. Again, the book is Our Final Invention by James Barrett. It started me reading four or five other books at the same time on the same topic. In the New York Times, for example, just a couple weeks ago, December 14th, the New York Times Magazine lead story was entitled The Great AI Awakening. And, of course, that's artificial intelligence. But it specifically mostly talks about how Google used artificial intelligence to transform a program they've had for several years, Google Translate, which is one of its more popular services. You can actually just feed in text. And it comes back to you, translated into another language. And there's at least it's a couple dozen languages, but the point of the article is that the artificial intelligence is using what's referred to as a neural network to be sort of like our brain. It's learning how to do better all the time. And there was a big breakthrough just a couple of years ago, and now the translations are almost better than a human being can do, and they preserve a lot of the, you might say, artistry of expression, it's absolutely amazing. In other words, the artificial intelligence in this regard, in terms of translation, is learning how to do better all the time, and there was a big breakthrough. It's now as good as humans. Wow. In terms of doing translation. And it's moving up exponentially in its ability. The book, Our Final Invention, suggests that artificial intelligence be looked at as two things. One is sort of like single-purpose artificial intelligence to help us do a single activity, and that's it. Okay, and it'll never learn to do more. Artificial general intelligence, that would have to be some sort of supercomputer, but there's many of these in the world now, that are starting to learn to improve themselves, by themselves, okay? Such as the Great AI Awakening, talked about in the New York Times Magazine just 2 weeks ago, which has made a breakthrough in its abilities to be human and, in fact, to surpass humans. And the other term from the book is ASI, Artificial Super Intelligence. That's where artificial general intelligence machines learn to improve themselves at exponential rates and become very quickly super intelligent, which is much more intelligent than human beings, and able to learn and grow and even sustain themselves to learn how to, because of course, staying alive is a priority for humans and computers. Once they reach that state of consciousness, if you want to call it that, they will find ways to perpetuate themselves too, to make sure that they're needed. And so I started, and of course, one of the conclusions that a supercomputer would have is that the cause of most problems on this planet, where it's air pollution, depletion of natural resources, it's the cause of human beings. I mean, it's pretty easy to say that we did it. Now, will the computer, the supercomputer, the ASI, get us out of this? Or will they resolve the problem by eliminating human beings?
By checking them out, yeah.
Now, one other way to do it is to give us artificial implants, and we become part of a hive mind, with computer implants, and then we become cyborgs, really. I'm thinking of the Borg from Star Trek, The Next Generation. Resistance is futile. Where they absorb all the intelligences and sort of develop throughout the universe by just absorbing all the life forms and something we would want to fight against, yes. But it looks like there's no way of resisting this. Unless we can get some really good programming together, and certain science fiction writers, like Isaac Asimov with his iRobot series, suggested ways that we could program robots. He didn't start talking about ASIs. He didn't think about that. To not hurt us, no matter what. That was naive, as is said now. And so I think... In short terms, you say, well, Kornick, we can't do anything about it. Who cares? Let's just forget it. And when it happens, it happens. Yeah, but again, we might be able to program our way out of this somehow. And that's the biggest problem I see coming up short term. The biggest big problem. The small term problem is where the jobs be for all the workers. Because we won't need workers when the factories get automated. In fact, there's a good book I'm also reading called The Rise of Robots. Yeah. And also the first novel by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. From 1952. His first novel was called Player Piano, which is about the mechanization and of industry and the displacement of human beings. That will happen very rapidly in the next 5 or 10 years to an extent that nobody will be able to create more jobs, especially not for manufacturing. So things to think about and talk about, folks, here. Got to say goodbye for now because 2017 is almost here. John, you've got 30 seconds.
Well, a very happy new year to all of our listeners. Be good to each other. That'll help. I believe that'll help for the new year 2017. Good, and thanks for working with me, Jay. It's been a great year as far as.
Well, thanks for your
concerned.
Being here, John. Thanks and so much. And to as I said at the beginning of the show, to all of our WHFR volunteers for keeping us going for this whole year. We're beginning now our 32nd year, and now it's time for Highway 61. It's WHFR Dearborn. Kitty Love is ready to go, so take it away.
Time. Now that's where my